Okay, good morning, everyone.
Before I get to Ephraim and Manasseh, which is where we're headed, I did want to go back because I read something interesting from Jonathan Sacks, who's the chief rabbi of Britain, at least for a little while longer. And he talks about a passage that we just read not so long ago, where Joseph says to his brothers, I'm Joseph, I'm your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Don't be distressed and don't be angry for selling me, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years there's been famine, but God sent me to preserve life, etc. So Rabbi Sacks says this is the first recorded moment in human history where one human being forgives another, which I found very interesting. And he quotes a book recently written by David Constant, who's a classics professor, called Before Forgiveness, The Origins of a Moral Idea. And what Constant says is that there is no forgiveness in ancient Greek literature. There's appeasement of anger, but that's not the same as forgiveness. And that this, as far as he knows, is the first example of forgiveness in literature, which would, if true, would be a fascinating observation. Although I think that it's not, I have to say, it's not as clear as we would like that Joseph forgives his brothers. It seems that way, and you can certainly make the case that he does, but if you wanted to make the contrary case, you could, that he doesn't punish them, but whether he forgives them in his heart is hard to know. It's just hard to know. Because remember, the brothers, well, we haven't gotten to it yet, but after Jacob dies, the brothers say, you know, Dad said you should forgive us, which means that at least they had some doubt as to whether Joseph had forgiven them or not. And by the way, it's not clear whether Jacob really did say it, but we'll come to that. In any case, I thought that that was a fascinating observation. It, among other things, it tells us that there's nowhere earlier in the Bible where anybody forgives. And it might be that it's the earliest recorded instance in literature of one person forgiving another, which would make it particularly notable, and I didn't want to pass it by. Okay, we're now on chapter 48, verse 8. Remember, Joseph has brought his kids to his father, and it says, noticing Joseph's sons, Israel asked, who are these? Now, that's an interesting comment there. Did he not know who Joseph's sons were? It's possible that he had never seen them before. Although you've got to assume that Joseph coming in with two young men, Jacob must have thought, unless Joseph always comes in with servants or Joseph doesn't visit him, that they were his children. But he also could have forgotten their names, which is not uncommon for elderly grandparents and grandchildren, especially if they're not that close. Don't know. But Joseph doesn't answer by giving them the names. He says, they're my sons whom God has given me here. In other words, they're not born in Israel, right? These are the children that I had in Egypt since I've been estranged from you. Bring them to me, he said, that I may bless them. Now Israel's eyes were dim with age. He could not see. That could be an explanation for why he didn't know who they were, or it could be an explanation for why he says, bring them to me. He obviously could see at least somewhat, because otherwise he wouldn't say, who are these? Right? He must have at least perceived the shapes. But what does this remind you of? Yeah, this is a clear look back at the blessing of Jacob and Esau and the way that he stole the blessing, the younger from the older, because Isaac couldn't see. And Isaac really couldn't see, which is why Jacob could deceive him about who he was, because remember, he put fur on his arms so that he felt hairy like Esau, and he came before his father, and his father said, you know, the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he said, you know, Ani Esav Bechorcha, I am Esav, your firstborn, which the rabbis try to parse so that Jacob isn't lying, but it's a stretch. They try, if you remember, they try to put a semicolon in there. I am, Esau is your firstborn. what can I tell you? They were lawyers, the rabbis. But nonetheless, here it's clearly that scene, and what you would expect from the scene is exactly what you expect there, which is that some deception, some anger, some recrimination, some outcome would result from this blessing of the younger and the older. So Joseph brought them close to him, and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see you again, and here God has let me see your children as well. Which is a really very beautiful moment, and makes it different from, we'll get to that in a minute. The question of grandparents. So Joseph then removed them from his knees and bowed low with his face to the ground. Joseph took two of them, Ephraim with his right hand to Israel's left, and Manasseh with his left hand to Israel's right, and brought them close to him. But Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, though he was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, thus crossing his hands, although Manasseh was firstborn. And he blessed Joseph, saying, The God in whose ways my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd from my birth to this day, the angel who has removed me, who has redeemed me from all harm, bless the lads. And them may my name be recalled, and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they be teeming multitudes upon the earth. When Joseph saw that his father was placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, he thought it wrong, so he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's. Not so, father, Joseph said to his father, for the other is the firstborn, place your right hand on his head. But his father objected, saying, I know, my son, I know. He too shall become a people, and he too shall be great. Yet his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his offspring shall be plentiful enough for nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, By you shall Israel invoke blessings, saying, God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Thus he put Ephraim before Manasseh. Okay, now there's a lot to say about this. Let me start by saying that you'll notice it says that he blesses Joseph. Right? If you look in verse 15, it says, and he blessed Joseph, saying, because blessing his children was blessing Joseph. Right? That's the first point that I want to make. And then the question is, why Ephraim and Manasseh? That is, why is it that, I mean, for the most obvious reason is that Jacob says, by you shall Israel invoke blessings, saying, God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Right? So it's almost like a lead, a directive, that's what God says we should do. But the question is, why Ephraim and Manasseh? Why don't you say, for example, which would make more sense, you should be like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, in the same way that you say for a girl, like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Right? That would make much more sense. So in rooting around for various explanations, I came across an article written by a professor at Bar-Ilan, who gives five different reasons. He's, by the way, from the Department of Mathematics. You gotta love that. You know, only the Jews, the mathematics professors, are writing drashot on the Torah. It's wonderful, it's just wonderful. I should give you his name because I'm about to quote from his article. His name is Eli Mertzbach, Department of Mathematics at Bar-Ilan University. So he, in fact, just wrote this year, 2012, Why Ephraim and Manasseh? The first explanation he gives, he said he heard from his mother, which is also quite beautiful. He said, who told the following story of her father, a devout Jewish doctor from the city of Mulhouse in Alsace, France. Despite living in great isolation in a tiny Jewish community situated in non-Jewish surroundings, he managed to educate his 12 children to follow the Torah. Both Ephraim and Manasseh grew up and lived in a hostile non-Jewish environment without Jewish education, right? They grew up in Egypt. There weren't any Torah teachers in Egypt, and Joseph probably didn't know that much. Nevertheless, they grew up to be good Jews, believing in God and following the ways of their forefathers. So, too, we bless our children that even in difficult surroundings, amidst the Gentiles, bear in mind this practice was instituted in Jewish communities outside of Israel, because remember, he's writing at Bar Ilan, our children succeed in growing up according to the Jewish tradition, keeping the Torah, therefore we deliberately mention Ephraim and Manasseh. That's a really wonderful explanation. And also, Ephraim and Manasseh, remember, are the only ones of the tribes born outside of the land of Israel. And this idea of giving to later generations examples of diaspora spirituality, that is, Jews who keep Jewish tradition in the diaspora, proved to be enormously important. And it's, as you know, one of the explanations why the Torah ends while the Jews are still in the desert, right? We've talked about this before, that it would make more sense for the Torah to end once the Jews enter the land of Israel, because that's the whole point of the Torah, is that they're supposed to get to the land of Israel, and yet when they finish with the book of Devarim, they're still in the desert. And one explanation of why the Torah ends in the desert is to encourage those later generations who will be outside the land of Israel to realize that the Torah is for you, that it's for people outside of Israel, that it's not true that the only point of the Torah is for Jews who live in the land of Israel, because for generations to come, Jews who live outside of the land of Israel are going to need that kind of encouragement. And so every time you bless Ephraim and Manasseh, what you're saying is, I hope that even though you live outside the land as they did, you'll be able to keep the Torah and so on and so forth the way Ephraim and Manasseh did. Which is a beautiful and it makes sense as an explanation. That certainly wasn't true of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all of whom lived in the land. In fact, Isaac never left the land of Israel. He was the only one of the patriarchs who never did. He always lived in Israel. So that's one. Here's the second explanation of why Ephraim and Manasseh. Why would you bless Ephraim and Manasseh and not bless the patriarchs? Because Ephraim and Manasseh are grandchildren. And grandchildren represent continuity better than children do. Right? You have a much better sense of how you influenced your children when you see how they raised their children. Because as we all know, things kick in once you have your own children that don't mean anything to you before you have your children. And it's very hard to gauge what values you've transmitted to your kids if you don't have the privilege of seeing them raise their own children. That's when you really see what comes out and what doesn't. That he says, this is the first time in the Torah and perhaps the first in the history of mankind, to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that a grandfather blesses his grandchildren. Right? We don't have another example of that in literature either, just as this may be the first example of forgiveness, it may be the first example of a grandparent blessing grandchildren, which he says is also something, and I think that this is a really interesting observation, something that doesn't exist in the animal world. I wonder, from animal studies, is there any documented case of grandparents feeling a special attachment to grandchildren? I don't know, because I don't know if that's biological or cultural, to feel an attachment to your grandchildren as opposed to your children. So we know, obviously, from the animal world that there's a tremendous attachment to children on virtually every species, but grandchildren, I don't know. But for human beings, that attachment is obviously very powerful. So the second reason he says that Ephraim and Manasseh could be the ones who are blessed is because it shows a greater example of continuity than if it were just a blessing of Joseph, who is Jacob's child. And then the Sfat Emet, he quotes the Sfat Emet as saying the following. The Baal Tshuva, and a Baal Tshuva is somebody who comes back to the Jewish tradition, okay, must continue in a new path in order to make amends for that which has been spoiled. In this manner, Jacob laid a new road and elevated the sons of Joseph so they would adhere to their forefathers, and the 12 tribes adhered to the level of the patriarchs. Just as Jacob elevated the status of Ephraim and Manasseh to that of the other tribes, We bless our children in the hope that they have the good fortune of seeing them elevated to the status of tribes, which was the level of the patriarchs. In other words, all the other brothers had grown up in Jacob's influence. Joseph didn't. So Jacob had to do something new to raise Joseph to the same status as the people who'd grown up in his house, and he did that by raising his children to that status, so that he granted these two children the same status as the other tribes. Which means that when he blessed them, he sort of gave them a great spiritual boost, greater in some ways than blessing their children, because what he did was he elevated his grandchildren to the spiritual stature of his children, which was the stature of the 12 tribes. So since that blessing had greater power than the blessing of his children, because it was a special elevation of status to the level of his children, we bless our children with it in the hope that it will have a special power of elevating them too. That's the Sfat Emet. The Sfat Emet always goes for the spiritual explanation, right? That's just his, that's the way that he always answers questions. So he looks for what's the spiritual secret in any verse, and for him the spiritual secret here is that Jacob used this to take these two children who were born in Egypt and didn't have a Jewish education and raise them to the status of his own children who had grown up in his house. Okay? What's the fourth explanation, you wonder? The fourth explanation is the one that we usually give, and that is that, bless you, Ephraim was great in learning and Manasseh was great in labor. And so you bless a child that they will be both, in other words, both intellectually and not just physically. Physically is too specific, that they will both, that they'll find fulfillment both in hard work and also in study. Let's put it that way. Because remember that unlike today, when rabbis are lazy, in the times of the Talmud, the rabbis all had professions. Nobody made their living from being a rabbi, right? They all had professions. They were carpenters and cobblers and landowners and merchants and all those things because nobody paid you for studying Torah. And you know that even today, in theory, you're not supposed to actually pay a rabbi for studying or teaching Torah, and sometimes in certain, or not teaching, you can pay someone for teaching, but not for being a rabbi. So in certain contracts of traditional synagogues, they'll specify this or that particular responsibility that they're paying the rabbi for, but they're not paying the rabbi for being a rabbi, because you're not supposed to make your living by Torah, right? And then lastly, which was actually the explanation that I was going to give before, which I think is in some ways the explanation that ties the book of Bereishit together most comprehensively, is that all of Bereishit from the time of Isaac onward is about strife between brothers. And in particular, it's about strife between the younger brother who gets the blessing and the older brother who gets a lesser or doesn't get the blessing. Right, so Yishmael gets thrown out of the house, and Isaac gets the blessing of continuity. So Jacob gets the blessing from Isaac, and Esau is deprived of the blessing. And each time, it leads to some kind of strife or hostility or anger. Joseph is the favored one, and he's the younger one, and his brothers throw him into a pit and into slavery. And here, for the first time, the younger gets the blessing instead of the older, but nobody protests, there's no fight, there's no anger, and it's the first time that the children of Israel have demonstrated sufficient maturity to be able now to become the people of Israel. So the other reason that you bless like Ephraim and Manasseh is that everybody should accept who they are in this world, what their particular gifts and blessings are, and not be jealous, angry, so on, that they didn't get what someone else got. And so for those five reasons, and it may be that you can come up with others as well, the blessing that we give our sons on Friday night is like Ephraim and like Manasseh. I don't know the origin of Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, although there's no particular equivalent. I assume that the idea was just that you, I mean, I can't imagine who else you would take other than the four, right, exactly. Who else would you bless them to be like unless you took somebody outside the Torah? There are, later in the Tanakh, there are other women figures, Deborah, Ruth, so on, that you could bless someone with being, but if you're going to do it in the Torah, then Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah seem to me to be the obvious candidates. So the other thing that I wanted to say about the blessing is Rabbi Aryeh Levin, who was a rabbi in Israel who was renowned for the saintliness of his character. He spent his life visiting prisons and was revered. It was a wonderful character. I wish I could remember the name of the biography. There's a biography of him that's very inspiring and beautiful. I think it's called A Tzaddik for Our Times, but I'm not sure. Anyway, he made a beautiful comment about Jacob's blessing Ephraim and Manasseh by crossing his hands. He said, when you stand opposite someone, your right is on their left and your left is on their right. He said, and too often, that's how we judge people. That is, we look at their weaknesses with our strengths, and when we see their strengths, we respond with our weaknesses. But Jacob is showing you the proper way to do it, which is you cross your hands, and you should respond to someone's strengths with your strengths, and when you see someone's weaknesses, you should remember your own weaknesses, which is a beautiful observation about this. And I think is an example of something that I think comes out of probably his experience, because as I said, he spent much of his life visiting people in prison in Israel. So Jewish prisoners, he used to make seders in the prison and things like that for people. And so that's probably a product of his experience. The truth is, we don't really know much about Ephraim and Manasseh other than this. And we know that Joseph had other children, but these are the two that get elevated by Jacob to the status of the tribes. Let's finish off this chapter, and then we'll do questions and comments, and next time we'll do all the blessings. In the next chapter, then Israel said to Joseph, now notice in this, he's Israel, Hine Anochi Met, which in biblical Hebrew, there's no way to say I am about to die exactly. So the way you say it is, here I die, right? Behold, I die. That's basically what he's saying to him. And God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. But he doesn't say when, obviously. But he does let Joseph know once again that that's the goal, right? That eventually you go back. And I give you one portion more than to your brothers, which I wrested from the Amorites with my sword and bow. Now, what he means by this, of course, is that the other reason that Jacob blessed Joseph's two children is because now Joseph gets twice as much as any other son. Because Ephraim and Manasseh, each tribe gets two, right? Each tribe gets one. So Joseph has two kids who get it, so Joseph really gets two. He's represented, maybe there's not a tribe of Joseph, but his children get twice as much as he does. Which is interesting for a couple of reasons. First of all, you could easily say that Jacob is committing the exact same sin that got him in trouble in the first place, right? The whole problem here was that he favored Joseph instead of the other kids, and to the very end, he's favoring Joseph instead of the other kids. And we don't know, at least it's not recorded in the Torah, we know that Ephraim and Manasseh didn't argue about it. We have no idea how Shimon and Levi and Yisachar and Zvulun and all those other guys felt about the fact that Joseph gets two, although they certainly are in no position to complain considering the fact that Joseph is the vizier of Egypt and they're now living by his sufferance, right? Because the only reason they're protected is that he's at the right hand of Pharaoh. The other way of looking at it is that Jacob now is making up to Joseph for what happened to him. And maybe even though it may not have been nice for him to favor him before, you got to figure that the brothers have to pay some price for what they did to their brother. And it's not unreasonable to say, whatever Joseph's sins, right? Even if he was an obnoxious young man, even if he was arrogant, even if he was self-regarding, he certainly did not deserve to be thrown into a pit and sold to the, you know, sold into slavery in Egypt, right? That he didn't deserve. So he certainly deserves some compensation from the brothers, and the only thing that they can give other than their sorrow is the blessing of their father. So you could argue that Jacob is doing what is only just, which is the fact that Joseph has succeeded on his own is nothing that the brothers did for him, right? That's not recompense from the brothers. That's Joseph's own ability. So this is some recompense from the brothers. Jacob is taking something, one-tenth of each of their 10 tribe allotments and giving it and dividing it, you know, to give an extra tribe allotment to Ephraim or to Manasseh. And that seems like a fairly small price to pay, considering really the magnitude of their sin, which was to plot to murder their brother and in the end only spare his life because they sold him into slavery. Which is, remember, that was at least what the assumption was, that he was going to be a slave. It wasn't that he went to Egypt thinking that he was going to be a servant in the house of Potiphar or accede to near kingship. And then the third observation about this is that it is Jacob's. It is, after all. I mean, it's his inheritance to give as he wishes and as he sees fit. And there is I've had this argument played out in my office before, and you can imagine it, which is, from the point of view of the children, it's only fair that you give us our share. From the point of view of the parent, I created this business, and therefore I actually get to allot it the way I choose. The fact that you were born to be my child doesn't mean actually that I have to give you the percentage that you think is fair of the business that I made. Go make your own business and you can give it away the way you want. But this is my business. And Jacob has a right to say, that's why, by the way, he ends with saying, I wrested from the Ammonites with my sword and my bow, right? I fought for this land. I get to distribute it the way I want. If you don't think it's fair, all I can say is, you get to do to your children what I'm doing to you, right? Pay it forward if you want, but you don't actually get to say what is fair for me if I'm the one who... Now, if you inherited the business from your parent, you have less of a claim, right? And even though Jacob inherited the idea of it and the birthright, he specifically says, I fought for it, which gives him the right to allot it the way that he wants. And this this is not unlike Rashi's explanation, remember, of the beginning of the Torah. You may or may not remember, Rashi quotes Rabbi Yitzchak from the Talmud in a question that wouldn't occur to any of us. He says, why does the Torah begin with the creation of the world? Which for Rashi is a question because the point of the Torah is to give you Jewish law. Otherwise, what do you need a Torah for? You don't need a Torah for nice stories. You need a Torah for the law. And the first 12 chapters before the Brit Milah, except for Pru Rvu, be fruitful and multiply, which, you know, is easily enough said, they don't have any law in them. So what do you need them for, says Rashi? Why do you have to read all this about how God created the world? And his answer, which again comes out of the Talmud, but the answer that Rashi chooses for his first comment on the Torah is, God made the world, and therefore God is saying to the nations, I can allot the lands however I choose, and it's my right to give the land of Israel to Israel. So for Rashi, the whole story of creation is just so that we can point to the Torah and say to the nations, look, God made the world, so we get to have the land of Israel. Okay, Rashi, by the way, writing in the 11th century in France, okay, wrote this. But he anticipated, because remember that it was actually Rashi writing in the 11th century in France. It made a lot of sense because France was a Christian land, and therefore they all accepted the veracity of the Torah. He didn't live in a world in which someone would say, your Torah is wrong. He lived in a world in which everybody, Christian and Jew, all thought that the Torah was true, and therefore he could make that argument. So the argument made perfect sense to him in its context, which is why, by the way, interestingly, Maimonides, I mentioned this once before, I don't remember if it was here or the Lunch and Learn, but it's just an interesting little factoid, and then we'll go to questions and comments. Maimonides, who only lived in Muslim lands in his life, okay? Maimonides, his family came from Spain, which was Muslim, and during the Almohad persecutions in Spain, they fled to a more tolerant Muslim community in Fostat, which was right outside Cairo, in Egypt. And that's where Maimonides grew up and lived and died. It was in Cairo, which is why the Cairo Geniza has all these documents that Maimonides wrote, which is amazing. Maimonides ruled that you were allowed to study the Torah with a Christian, even though Christianity was idolatry. And Islam, which was not idolatry, you were not allowed to study the Torah with a Muslim. And the reason that that's so is that the New Testament doesn't say that anything in the Torah is not true. It interprets it differently. But when you study the Hebrew Bible with a traditional Christian, they will never say, no, they got the story wrong. So if you study the Torah with a Christian, you both accept the truth of what's in the Torah, even if the Christian thinks that later on it was superseded, right? Even though it was substituted by a later interpretation. But the Quran retells some of the stories in the Torah and changes them, right? So for example, Ishmael is the one who gets taken up to the mountain and not Isaac. So Maimonides said, you can't study the Torah with a Muslim because they don't accept the truth of the Torah. And yet, he said, Christianity, especially he never lived in Christian lands, Christianity for Maimonides was clearly idolatry because you worship a statue. You worship a person, right? That's what Christianity is as far as he's concerned. And Islam, which is a very pure monotheism, right? You don't have images. It's very similar in that sense to Judaism. That he thought it was a much better religion than Christianity. But their mistake was, of course, that they didn't accept all the stories in the Torah. So it's a kind of weird combination, but it makes perfect sense. And that's why for Rashi, living in France, where he only knew Christians, I mean, there were no Muslims in France, as far as I know, in the time of Rashi. It's not that he had good relationships with Christians. In fact, Rashi lived through the First Crusade and saw terrible things. But despite the fact that he didn't have good relationships with Christians, he understood that they accepted the Torah. So anyway, by the way, Rashi too had a profession. He was a winemaker, right? So made some very good wines, Rashi. Who wouldn't buy if it said Rashi on the label, right? Stop there, and that's why those are at least some of the interpretations of why Jacob distributes the land as he does and feels that that's okay, despite the fact that, as I said, you could easily make the case that he's simply continuing the same disastrous trend of favoring Joseph that he had begun earlier. Before I take questions, let me just make one announcement so that I don't forget, which is Tuesday, January 31st, I believe it is, we're going to have a special Torah class. You'll get an email about it. It doesn't negate the Thursday class. We'll still have the Thursday class, but Leon Wieseltier, who came once before and was a big hit, is going to be in town. So I asked him if he would come and teach the class, and he's leaving Wednesday morning, so he's going to be teaching on Tuesday morning, January 31st, same time here again, normal Torah class, but on a Tuesday morning. So if you're able to come, I'm sure that you will benefit from it. So, yes?
Who was Joseph's wife and the mother of Menashe?
Well, her name was Asnat Bat Potiphara, so the usual rabbinic explanation is that she was Potiphar's daughter. But we don't, well, she couldn't have been Jewish. There were no Jews. But she, presumably she converted. I think she converted up at the AJU. The rabbis do make the assumption that some of the patriarchs married people who converted, or some of the figures in the Torah married people who converted, and that conversion is considered a legitimate way of entering the Jewish people. I mean, if it weren't, we would be a lot smaller than we are. So, yeah, she had to convert.
I have a question. Even though Jacob blesses Menashe and Ephraim, you would expect for them to continue the nation versus Judah, you know, like...
Right, well, we will... Yeah, we'll come to that, but you'll see when Jacob blesses him that he blesses Judah with a continuity. And we'll talk about why when we get to it. Yeah. You have it in the rabbinic... Where's the attribution of intellect and labor to Ephraim and Menashe? You have it in rabbinic texts. What the source for it is, I don't know. And he doesn't give a particular... he doesn't give the source here. In other words, why they decided that was true, I don't know. But I'll see if I can find out for next time. I think it might be... It might just be because they assume that those are the two great divides of human nature, and since you're supposed to be like both of them, presumably you're supposed to be like that. They must have been like that, but I don't know that there's any textual warrant for it. The only thing that is possible, and I have to think about it, is whether there's anything in their names, in the names Ephraim and Menashe, that would lead you to believe that, and I don't know. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. All right, Seb, we'll talk about the tribes next, okay, when we do the blessings. Let's save the tribes, because someone asked last time, too. We'll talk about all the tribes when we get to the blessings and why the count is the way it is and who the tribes are. Well, right hand is more important probably just because most people are right-handed, right? And it talks about God's right hand. And right hand is strength. And that's true of what percentage? What percentage of people are right-handed? Only 5% are left-handed, something like that. So the normal human experience is that the right hand is the strong hand. Well, I don't know where blessing came from other than I can't tell you how either, other than people have been blessing people from the beginning of time. I mean, it's all through the Torah people are blessing. And if you want to know more about the question of blessing, listen to last week's sermon, which I don't want to give again. But seriously, it's all about what blessing really means and what it means to bless God. It's exactly on that topic. So if you are interested, it should be on the internet. Yeah. Right. Right.
You know, traditionally it's supposed to come from chivalry, but it's also something to do with meeting someone as an equal until you know differently.
Right, right, right. And also, I've heard, although I don't know if it's true, it's to show that you don't have a weapon in your hand. That's why you put out your hand. But I actually think it's intended to pass germs is the main, is the principal reason that we shake hands, so that you can infect the natives. If you don't have a tubercular blanket handy. I remember my brother who went to, my oldest brother went as an undergraduate to Amherst. And while he was there, he discovered that Jeffrey Amherst passed tubercular blankets to the natives. And he was so upset that was the namesake of the college that he was going to. But that was one of the ways we won the war, just in case you were wondering, was bringing old world diseases to the new world. And yep. It's like, did you ever see War of the Worlds or read the book, the H.G. Wells book? There's an alien invasion, and they're much more powerful than human beings, but eventually germs fell them, right? That's what that's how infectious diseases are, you know, are how the aliens die off and human beings get to keep our planet. So the role of disease in history is a huge one. Actually, there's a historian, William McNeil, who wrote a book about that. Anyway, I think that's, but the idea that one person can bless another and greet another, and all the conventions of greeting and blessing and so on, they're all through the Torah and all through other ancient texts. Yeah. Right. Yeah. No. I've heard that said, but I wouldn't say it. Because as a child, it doesn't mean that your need for parental affection is diminished, and to hear a parent say you're diminished, not a good strategy. Talk about how much you love your grandchildren, not about how much the children are diminished. Okay? That would be my not having been a grandparent, that would be my off the cuff advice to you. Always augment, don't diminish. Yeah.
I think you've covered this before, but I'm still puzzled by the ambiguity in chapter 48 to 49 of Israel vs. Jacob, and then 49 begins with Jacob.
Right.
And it seems to me that either that it's just stenography itself, which I don't believe.
It's hard to figure out all the time, and you can make an excuse for each one, but it is hard to figure out the exact. Right, you would think that Jacob would, it says Jacob calls his sons, but right before it's Israel said to Joseph. Yeah.
And it seems if I follow the pronoun, I think it means Israel is giving a blessing, but I'm really not sure.
Right, yeah.
And that is puzzling to me.
It is puzzling, I agree with you. But they do go back and forth, and I gave a couple explanations in the past, but obviously Jacob represents both. He represents both the corporate entity and also the individual. And why they use one name in one place and one name in another. As I said, there are explanations that all the commentators use, but none of them track entirely well. The same thing with names of God.
Yeah, I just want to backtrack to last week, because you kind of had me thinking when you talked about the promises, why Joseph promised twice to him. And I was thinking about that, and it talked about in the beginning, when he found out that he was dead, he said that he wouldn't stop mourning until his death, the death of Joseph, how much it was painful and how much hurt. And also I was thinking that the idea of Joseph's position kept a part where there was no alienation. I mean, if he turned everything over to Joseph, then obviously, you know, he saw leadership ability, he saw a person who was very righteous, a person who had really moved up from hardships. I can't even imagine being pulled away from my tribe, which is my life,
right,
and now put in a whole different environment.
Right.
And he survived in a way which was incredible leadership. And I can see that he was the only person that could administer this without the dysfunctional family and all the envy and anger. And he chose him. And they wouldn't really, they could say things quietly, but they weren't going to interject. I felt that Joseph had the power. And he chose the right person.
Well, in the context, he chose the right person early on, or he chose the right person when he came to Egypt?
Yeah, at the end.
Right, there is no choice.
Well, there wouldn't be any argument.
Although he does not, as we'll see next time, he does not choose Joseph or Joseph's children to be the ones who eventually lead Israel. But we'll come to that. So, because it's not Ephraim and Manasseh, it's Judah who becomes the eventual leader of Israel. But why that is, we'll come back to. We talked about it in part when we went through Judah's story in chapter 38, I believe it is. But nonetheless, once he comes to Egypt, Joseph is clearly the only one who's capable of administrating. He's the only one who has the power. He's the only one who has a voice in Egypt. He's the only one who's demonstrated that kind of ability, as far as we know. So, yeah. No? Yes?
I was just reading in the commentary that it's traditional to bless before Kiddush, and is there a particular Seder or?
I mean, it's
does it make a big difference?
No.
Should I change?
Nah. I don't think that it particularly matters, you know. No. I think different families have different traditions, and whenever you do it is fine. I don't think it diminishes the power of the blessing before, during, after. So I wouldn't I don't think that it's necessary to change, but yeah.
Does each tribe's men have?
We'll come to the tribes next week. We will talk to them. We'll talk about it. I mean, all the Hebrew names have meanings, but we're not, and all the you could spend a long time in the blessings, and we won't. All the blessings have meanings, but yeah, they all do. Although some more than others. Yeah. Suggested a book by? No, I didn't. I suggested a couple of columns that David Brooks had written about people at the end of their lives.
Illusions of something.
What? I can't.
Illusions of, it was a book about illusions of religion, something like that. No?
David Brooks never wrote a book about illusions of religion. I mean, you can listen to the class online and you'll hear it. The only thing I remember was talking about the fact that he wrote columns about people who had, he asked people to write in at age 75 and older about the stories of their lives. And that there were, and that he wrote a couple columns about it. But his most recent book was called The Social Animal, but it wasn't about religion, David Brooks. Yeah, I think that may have been it, but it wasn't about religion particularly. I think I was talking about how you divide your life into different periods. What's that? Right, sources of happiness, right, the way you divide your life into different periods and so on. I think that was it. Sure. Other? Okay then. Please rise.